You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The word lobbyist seems to be one that causes most Americans to shake their heads and wonder. The term has become pejorative and brings to mind shady deal-making and unfairness. But in the recently published book, The Ethical Lobbyist, political scientist Thomas Holyoke of Fresno State University offers the idea that lobbying itself is not a bad thing. And he joins me now. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
So for a lot of people, that ethical lobbyist sounds like an oxymoron. What have we been missing?
Well, the point of the matter is that we live in a society which is pretty heavily fragmented into many different kinds of groups, many different kinds of interests. And it's very difficult for elected officials, especially at the national level, to provide, you know, good, clear representation for all these different groups. And, you know, one of the ways our society has traditionally coped with that is by forming interest groups, a whole variety of interest groups. And today we have about 8,000 interest groups actively lobbying in Washington, D.C., and, you know, in the states, there's, you know, across the nation, we're probably thinking about, you know, 20,000 or so. And the lobbyist, the person who is actually responsible for connecting people organized as groups to lawmakers, you know, the act of lobbying itself is actually protected by the Constitution of the United States and the First Amendment. At the very end of the First Amendment, we have what's called the Petitioning Clause. That is, Congress can make no law that interferes with the right of people to petition government for a redress of grievances. And the Supreme Court has argued in several cases that essentially this provides a constitutional protection for lobbying.
So if we had enough lobbyists to cover all the disparate groups, would that make it a more effective system? Are we talking about having lobbyists who are really thinking more about what the people they're representing need, as opposed to the fact that, well, I'm pretty good at this, maybe I can represent a few more people and make a little bit more money?
Well, this is where we get into some of the trouble. You know, the constitutional protection assumes that the lobbyist is only going to lobby for exactly what the people he or she represents wants and nothing else. And unfortunately, given the way that the system works, lobbyists have various kinds of incentives to do some other things that their employers might not approve of. And one of them is try to stretch themselves out in different ways to attract new clients. And, you know, if the interests of one client interferes at all, or there's a conflict of interest with the interests of other clients, then we've got a problem, and you can't have good, honest, ethical representation. Also, there's the problem that, you know, lobbyists are only effective when they have solid relationships with the lawmakers they're trying to influence. And sometimes that can mean that lawmakers can then turn around and put pressure on lobbyists to, you know, try to change the interests of the people the lobbyist is trying to represent, and try to get the lobbyists to, you know, agree to compromises that the people the lobbyists represent probably wouldn't agree to. And so you have all these distortions and being, you know, built into the system here. And anytime the lobbyist is in a position where he or she is not advocating for exactly what their employers want, then we have essentially unethical lobbying, because the constitutional protection only, this is what I argue, the constitutional protection only protects lobbying if that lobbying is honest and straightforward.
Tom, the word influence came out there, and I know probably listeners, when they hear influence, they're thinking that's a negative as well. In and of itself, I don't think it should be, but it does come across that way. Do you think that has become pejorative too?
Oh, sure. Okay. Sure, lobbying is pejorative, influence is pejorative. And essentially, what a lobbyist is trying to do is make sure that even an ethical lobbyist is trying to make sure that the needs and wants and desires and interests of the people he or she represents are heard, you know, more loudly and more clearly by lawmakers than anybody else, trying to get the lawmaker to act to help the interests that the lobbyist is representing. But lawmakers themselves are, you know, lots of lobbyists, lots of different interests are vying for their attention. And that's when the lawmaker then can turn around and often pressure lobbyists into making compromises that the people employing the lobbyists may not want. So we have influence, but we have influence moving in a number of different directions. Lobbyists trying to influence lawmakers, but lawmakers also putting pressure and influence on lobbyists.
Tom, in a moment, I'm going to have a prominent Arizona lobbyist join us in the conversation, but I did want to ask you one specific question about Washington, D.C. It seems as though making reforms at that level, even reforms you're talking about that might make sense, would mm-hmm. be even more difficult considering all the power attached to K Street and whatnot that we often hear about. Sure. Is this something that would have to start at a grassroots level, or do you think there could be reforms actually at the national level?
Well, we have lobbying registration laws right now. Mm-hmm. The argument I make in The Ethical Lobbyist is that it's not even that they aren't good enough, but they're sort of getting at the wrong kind of information, or at least they aren't including the information that's really necessary. What we have now is a system where lobbyists, registered and indicate, who they're representing. They indicate how much, money is being spent. The one thing that the current system does not require the lobbyist to disclose is precisely what policy position the lobbyist is lobbying for. You can't go to any of the records and figure out exactly what the lobbyist is lobbying for. So if the lobbyist decides to change, for whatever reason, what he or she is lobbying for, nobody would know about it, including the people who are employing the lobbyist.
That's political scientist Thomas Holyoke of Fresno State University. We'll continue the conversation coming up as Stan Barnes joins us. That's coming up next on Here and Now. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with political scientist Thomas Holyoke of Fresno State University, author of the book The Ethical Lobbyist. And joining me now is longtime Arizona lobbyist Stan Barnes of Copper State Consulting. Stan, I want to get your take on what the professor had to say, especially in terms of the relationship between a lobbyist and the lawmakers. You've been both. How important is that one-on-one relationship and the idea that each of you can trust each other, even though in politics people are wondering if trust is actually a real word?
Yeah, I am so excited that you're doing this topic. You're right on a very important point. Of course, I live in this world and I think it's very important, but there's so much misunderstanding about the role of the lobbyist that your listeners are getting a real treat today. And my hat's off to Tom, the author, because his insights are incredible. And I appreciate his writing and your interview. The short answer is this is self-government and all that means. It is imperfect, there is no doubt. But it's the worst except for all the others. And it has its problems, but it has its real charms. One of those charms is it is a relationship thing. It is a people thing. Lawmakers, as Tom said, lawmakers have a million demands on their time and attention. What a lobbyist in my world does best and most often is simply get their attention for a moment. Call that influence, call that whatever you want. But what it is focusing the decision maker on your issue. Doesn't mean you're winning them over. It doesn't mean you're getting what you want as the asker of the question. But you are getting that moment when the decision maker has decided to think about your issue. That itself is a very difficult thing in the world of politics.
And I know certainly you don't go in the business to, sing kumbaya. You're certainly in the business to make money and do well and succeed. But I do wonder at the same time, Tom also makes the point that lobbyists are sort of spread thin in some cases. And I wonder, do you think people would actually be served better? I mean, there are people who have incredible amounts of energy and intelligence, of course, but would they serve them better and would lobbying feel less pejorative to the general public if they felt like, oh, this person really believes in this because he's only representing one or two groups?
Yeah, that's really the delightful nuance of this conversation. I know everybody at the Capitol. I've known them all for 30 years, and I see people that are targeted one issue, work for an association or work for a particular company, and they have a different way and a different trust level on the issue, perhaps, than a contract lobbyist may have. I am a contract lobbyist. I have a number of clients from a rainbow variety of different things, and it is only by constantly telling the truth and all the truth as I know it that I can maintain credibility on a variety of topics, even though I'm not a home builder, I'm not a professor at U of A, I'm not a copper miner for Freeport. But when I talk about those clients at the legislature, I have credibility because I know more than the elected official, and B, I have a history of telling the truth to these people, even if it's the uncomfortable truth. So this is a delightful part of this conversation.
Tom Holyoke, one thing that comes to mind for me, Stan is a former lawmaker, as we mentioned, and there are a lot of former members of Congress who go into lobbying. Is that a concern in and of itself? Certainly we have regulations when it relates to that. Should they be stronger? Should they be enforced more? Or is that system working well?
Well, certainly we have a system that we sort of refer to it as the revolving door, where we have people who serve as lawmakers or serve as staff to lawmakers and then They build up a lot of knowledge. They build up a lot of connections, a lot of relationships, and then go into the lobbying practice and are able to essentially make money by selling their services or really selling the relationships they have. And sometimes the revolving door actually evolves fully, and you have lobbyists actually go back into government, usually working at higher, more important positions. The concern about that is that you have people, public servants, who then you have this incredible incentive then to build up these relationships and then get out as fast as possible, and then turn around and lobby the very people that they were just working for. And I've always thought it's good to have perhaps a longer cooling off period, a longer amount of downtime between the time that you leave public employment and then you can actually lobby the people that you work for. I don't know what it is in Arizona, but I think in Washington, D.C., it's a year, or depending when you get out, it might be 2 years. But I've always been a proponent of having a longer period of waiting before you go back and, you know, make a lot of money off these kinds of relationships.
In Arizona, it's 1 year. I remember voting on that in the early 90s and never imagining I'd have to sit out for a year, but I ended up having to. I think there's a key distinction between, for your listeners, between Washington, D.C.'s revolving door and Arizona's reality. I am one of a very short list of people that have actually served in the legislature and are making a living as a contract lobbyist in Arizona. A very short list. I mean, less than one handful, really. And I think there is, in other words, there's not the same revolving door in Arizona. I don't exactly know why that is, but one of the phenomenons is Arizona's legislature turns over by, I don't know, a quarter or a third every time we have an election. And so any relationship you have with someone, that's evaporating even as you speak, and you cannot maintain a profession and clients won't hire you in the future if you don't actually have a certain degree of integrity and understanding of the rules of the game, separate from the speaker returns my call when I make that call.
What kind of expectations do people who hire you have for victory, let's say, because you certainly haven't won them all?
The more inexperienced and new to politics the client is, the more wrong their expectation is. The more sophisticated clients know that it is self-government and you don't always win and it is chaotic and all of those things. And so I really don't like taking on clients that have a all-in, leave it all on the battlefield, take that hill, we're going to win or we're going to die. That sort of thing generally is against my selfish interest short-term, because you burn up all of your political capital and all of your relationship and for what? For a client who is just going to go away. So in my world, in my industry, having clients that are sophisticated and understand that government outcomes are uncertain, that's the best kind of client. And most that deal at the Capitol understand that it is an uncertain place.
Tom, is that one of those things that can hurt when it comes to ethical lobbying, this idea that clients may in fact hire former lawmakers because they think, oh, they've not only do they have an in, they can sort of twist some arms better than I could. And then when it does not emerge that way, then that can cause more problems, or that might cause a lobbyist to cut some corners, certain lobbyists to do that.
Well, it depends, of course, on the personal on the lobbyist personally. But certainly the client who expects, you know, immediate results or an immediate policy change during that particular session of the legislature is in for a world of disappointment, as Mr. Martin said. It just doesn't really work that way. Usually a lobbyist has to spend a fair amount of time, you know, building up the case, you know, probably pulling together a coalition and, you know, utilizing the relationships the lobbyist has to, you know, ultimately maybe bring about the desired policy. And even then there's never any kind of guarantee. But again, very often the lobbyists will have to make, you know, compromises in order to get anything at all. That's just the nature of a democratic process and a system of separated powers. The important thing for the person who employs the lobbyist is to always be kept informed. You know, this is what's going on. This is what you can reasonably expect. And if I have to make a change, make a compromise, I'm going to tell you about it, and you're going to have to sign off on it. In fact, that's really one of the most important things, is that the client must always know exactly what the lobbyist is lobbying for at any given time and, you know, proactively approve it.
That's my favorite part of your interview so far with this author. That is a sophisticated nuance that very few understand, but lobbyists do understand, that clients can be really in the dark about what their advocate is doing at the state capitol. And I have seen advocate lobbyists at the state capitol doing a horrible job in outright conflicts and hiding the ball from their own client, because the client is not even in Arizona. They're out of state. They don't know how Arizona works, and they are totally reliant on whatever their client, their advocate, their lobbyist says, as is life, I guess. I mean, there are good and there are bad. I'm in my 20th year of doing this now after having left the state Senate. I'd like to think in part it's because I'm telling the truth to my clients as well and helping them with expectations. But the clients are generally in the dark about the machinations going on behind the curtain.
And we'll have to end the conversation there. Stan Barnes, longtime lobbyist for Copper State Consulting, and also Professor Thomas Holyoke of Fresno State University, the author of the book, The Ethical Lobbyist. Tom, thank you. Stan, thank you.
You bet.
Thank you very much.